America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. It's always refreshing when you can get an insider's take on something that rarely sees the light of day. For example, we just published a podcast a few weeks back on the opaque world of private equity. It's the first real exposé on the subject. Go back and check that one out. Today, we reveal what really goes on at the Food and Drug Administration as it relates to your food safety. I know that we've heard much about this powerful agency during the pandemic, surrounding the approval process for new therapies to deal with the scourge. But what about the other side of the house, the group that determines what goes on to food shelves across the country? While many say they don't trust the government, we've got to be real. You walk into an airplane and you assume the pilot is up to speed with his FAA certifications and trust that process. You walk into a building and you assume it's up to electrical code or meets building standards and has been inspected. That means you trust government and regulation. So let's go inside the FDA and get an insider's perspective as to whether we should have confidence in what we're consuming based on his many years on the inside. A unique view today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Dr. Richard A. Williams. He's an economist, a risk analyst, an op-ed writer, an expert in food safety and nutrition, and somebody who worked behind closed doors at the FDA from 1980 to 2007. Now, I say that because, Richard, you suggest that maybe there's not as much transparency as there should be in the Food and Drug Administration. You, of course, have been on the food side over the years. Lately, we've been exposed to a lot of what has been going on the drug side. So maybe you can tell us about the culture of the Food and Drug Administration.
To start with, one author called the Food and Drug Administration the most powerful regulatory agency in the world in the 20th century, and I think that's pretty accurate. As far as I know, I'm the only person to have spent their career at FDA and written about it afterward. Most of what's written about FDA comes from usually journalists interviewing senior people or political appointees, such as commissioners at the FDA, and writing books from that perspective. So I've just decided to write one about what goes on behind closed doors, typically not written.
Well, let me ask you, because we have been focused so much on COVID and the drug approval process within the FDA, I'm wondering which side of the house, the food or the drug, has more power?
It's hard to say which one has more power. Certainly everybody eats food, and FDA regulates nearly 80% of the food supply, everything except for meat and poultry. Drugs are incredibly important. They're both important. I don't know which one is more powerful, except the drug side of the house, everything that goes through drugs, and medical devices for that matter, is pre-approved. It means it can't go on the market until FDA says it can go on the market. In the food side of the house, any food or color additive also has to be pre-approved, but other than that, foods do not. They're regulated after they get onto the market.
That's really interesting, because I know with the drug approval process, one of the criticisms has been that oftentimes they're getting company data. And we've heard that, you know, the companies like Merck recently with the antiviral and, of course, those with the vaccines. And then they're interpreting that data And then again, you know, the approval process falls back on some of the work that the companies have done. I mean, how difficult is it for the Food and Drug Administration on the food side to assure us that the foods that we're eating are safe? As you suggest, many of them go onto the market before we know really what's going on with these products.
Well, generally what happens for most foods is that companies will make their own assessment and say, this is generally recognized as safe based on what FDA has already considered to be safe. But when we talk about keeping food safe, and this is one of the big myths that I'd like to expose, that FDA is really not keeping your food safe. So, for example, periodically we all hear there might be a government shutdown. The number one thing everybody says is if there's a government shutdown, our food will be unsafe because FDA isn't inspecting it. Well, in truth, FDA inspects food plants about once every 6 years. And I used to tell my classes, I said, that's like having a child and saying, I want you to keep your room clean and I'll be back once every 6 years to make sure that you do so. In fact, businesses inspect other businesses. For example, if you're an ingredient supplier, you get inspected by a final goods supplier. That happens at least weekly. Other than that, in terms of government inspections, the states actually do 85% of all government inspections.
You say that there are millions of private food safety contracts and inspections that the FDA ignores. Why is that?
Mostly because they're not doing it. And I think one of the things that could really help FDA in the future is to study that more, find out who's doing inspections, how often they're doing them. What are the criteria they're using to inspect? Because often the criteria that manufacturers use for themselves are much more rigorous than what FDA has. And then look for where there are gaps where you don't have that those relationships and those inspections, and FDA could focus their resources on those places. Certainly one way to focus your resources would be to inspect more incoming products from overseas.
Now, what is going on with the overseas products? I think my wife now is reading labels oftentimes to find out the origin of a particular product. And in many cases, of course, it's meats and poultry and the like, and that's not under their jurisdiction. But tell us how important that process has become as we have been importing so much more goods into America over the last 20, 30 years.
Well, it has become important, and I'm certainly not suggesting that it's more dangerous. It depends on where it's from. Certainly if it's from, for example, Europe, like England, you would expect it to have the same sort of quality assurance that we have here. Here's the problem, though, with these things. They come in these containers, which if you think about a truck, it has this big container, and it comes on ships, and, you know, thousands of containers come into the ports every year. If FDA wants to inspect them, they have to go and literally ask the person who's controlling the containers to unpack them so they can see what's in them. Other than that, if the container has left the port, they have to do what they call chase the container, meaning they got to go find out where it came from and track it down. So it's very difficult for FDA to have much control over what comes into the ports. And usually what happens is they'll get a tip from somebody that says this is something you ought to look at, from someone overseas.
If the FDA is one of the most powerful regulatory agencies, what does the performance of the FDA in this regard suggest? You point out that one in six people in America get food poisoning every year. And why don't we stop there, and then I want to go on. What does that tell us about the FDA, or what should it tell us about changes that need to be made?
Well, I can tell you what it tells me. What it tells me is that FDA every year goes to Congress and says to Congress, one in six people are getting sick from food poisoning, therefore you need to at least give us the same budget you gave us last year, if not an increase. So for the last decade, for example, FDA has had, just for foods, a $10 billion budget, but every year they make the same claim, one in six people are getting sick, as though that means we have to do something about it. Well, Congress doesn't have a memory much beyond a year, and so Congress never says, well, what did you do with the money that we gave you? Why aren't you making any improvements? And that is the problem. And I think part of it, the reason is that FDA right now is using old solutions. They're trying to make manufacturers use a food processing technology that's 50 years old. In fact, it was invented for the space program, for the Apollo space program. And I don't think that's where the solutions are going to come from. With the work I've been doing, I look at food safety solutions as coming from really innovations that are coming around the world in terms of making safer foods through new technologies, through things like new food packaging. We're finding nanotech food packaging that will alert you, for example, to when your food is going bad. Things like that, I think, are going to be the answer, and it's not going to be just more regulation.
When I look at what's going on with foodstuffs overall, and let's go into a grocery store. You and I are walking around, and on the outer ring, we've got fruits, we've got vegetables, we've got meat. And I guess some who are real purists in the food realm would say that's where the real food is. And everything internal are, well, developed by man. Those you suggest, man has had a role in virtually all that we eat and consume. And yet some of these products that come out, whether they're considered new and improved, they're all packaged. The nutritional content, we can talk about labeling as I know you want us to, and we should. You know, but really, they're not real foods in many cases. I mean, they fill us up, but what is the price we're paying? So how much are they looking at that? Aside from the food poisoning, now we're on to nutritional content, and we're on to the fact that Americans, whether it's by how much medication we consume, whether it's by what we're doing as pre-diabetics, obesity, by just about any measure, we're not a healthy society.
That's certainly right. Obesity, for example, has doubled for adults since the 1970s. It's quadrupled for children. Right now, one in two Americans is either pre-diabetic or diabetic. And by 2030, a Harvard study showed that half of us will be obese. We're definitely going in the wrong direction. But there is some work going on highly processed food suggesting that may be a problem. It is nowhere near ready, I think, to actually make that as a statement of fact. But there is a lot of myths around food. And one of the ones that I did focus on in the book is this idea that, well, you should only eat natural foods. Unfortunately, there's absolutely nothing natural that you eat. The hand of man has been in all foods for plants, maybe over 10,000 years, for animals, more like a couple of hundred years. We've been crossbreeding plants and animals for those years. Seeds, for example, in order to get new plant products, we still are bombarding them with radiation to see how they might change and see what comes out of that. So what's going on now that's better is we have precise ways of making changes in plants to get them to be hardier, if you will, able to sustain, you know, a lack of water, able to make them be more less susceptible to insects, and also to raise the yields, because we have a huge growing world population. And that's through genetic engineering. And a lot has been written about that. People are frightened of it. But in point of fact, so far it is shown to be a very precise, very safe technology.
So when we buy something out of season, I live here in the Northeast, and when I'm eating fruits and vegetables in the middle of February, what should I feel about where they're coming from, what it's taken to get them to me, and as opposed to what I might be eating in the summertime when I'm going to a local stand and I'm buying it there?
I can tell you how I feel. Looking at the history of food, the fact that you can eat fruits and vegetables in the middle of the winter is a wonderful thing. They have to be produced where the weather is warm, so that's great that we're able to get fruits and vegetables all year round, even in the middle of winter. So that's sort of my take on that. I don't look at it as a huge problem in terms of safety or nutrition. At least nothing that I've seen indicates that that's an issue.
We talk about labeling. You say that the labels are not terribly helpful. Someone other than a very educated consumer really doesn't even know what they're reading. I mean, I guess we read the top line about calories per serving. What else do we really read, and what should we be labeling the content of our food with?
I did the original research on labeling. My research showed at the time in the 90s that if people read the labels, if they understood what they were reading, and that caused them to change what they were buying, so they were buying healthier products, and ultimately I felt my research showed that that would reduce the cases of cancer and heart disease. That didn't happen. Food labeling is much, much more complex than most people can deal with. If you think about it, on any two food labels, or if you're deciding which food to buy, you're going to have to look at all of the different micronutrients. You're going to have to look at calories. You're going to have to look at saturated fat and sodium and fiber and so forth. And you're going to have to be able to compare, well, one's high in one and it shouldn't be, one's low in another and it shouldn't be. Which is the right one for me? Those comparisons are virtually impossible for almost anybody to make, and even nutritionists have difficulty with that. And that's one reason why they're not helpful. In addition, people don't track all those things. Hardly anybody tracks the exact amount of calories they eat during the day, because particularly if you're eating at a restaurant, you have to know how much you ate, how much calories were in whatever you ate. So it's extremely difficult to use these things. Initially, getting out of FDA, I thought that the answer might be symbols, where you would go in and you would look at these things and say, relatively, in this food category, this is a healthier product. But now I've come to understand that none of that is really going to help, because we are now understanding that people are absolutely individualistic. So just to give you an example, there's a study done a few years ago where they gave 600 people, they divided them in half, and half of them got low fat diets, and the other one got low carbohydrate diets. Well, on both diets, on average, they lost 10 to 12 pounds over a year. The problem was, though, if you look at the individuals, at one end, people lost 70 pounds. At another end, people gained 24 pounds, and everywhere in between there. So as it turns out, what was important was not the average of what happened, but what happened to each individual. And what you take away from that is there is no one diet that works for everyone. Unfortunately, the food label, My Food Plate, and the dietary guidelines all sort of are founded on this idea that we can give people rules, simple rules that will work for everybody. It turns out that's just not the case.
What about the food pyramid, which just seems to keep changing? There was a time when we said, gee, you shouldn't use anything that is, cholesterol-based, or then fat. I mean, we have had these varying changes over the years, and people have said, well, why should I listen at all? Because they keep changing the rules. And because chocolate was never one of the major four food groups, I just ignored it myself.
And actually, USDA changed that. That's now my plate. But it's pretty simple. It just divides foods into four categories. I don't know exactly what that's supposed to tell you. You know, there is a lot of problems with nutrition science. The first and biggest problem, I think, is that when we ask people what they ate over a 24-hour period, people either can't remember what they ate or they don't want to report how much they ate. And so what we find as a result of that is that 60% of people don't report eating enough food to stay alive. That's one of the reasons that these diet disease studies are so bad. And it's gotten so bad now that the former editors of the International Journal Lancet, which is one of the top journals in the world, and the former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, one of the top journals in the United States, both said they don't believe half of what they read in clinical studies, for example, anymore. So we do have a problem in science that we've got to fix.
Speaking of fixing, the book is called Fixing Food. An FDA insider unravels the myths and the solutions. Richard Williams, PhD, he is our guest today. What about all of the new labeling that we're seeing that make people feel so good about many of the foods that they're eating? And I'll give you three. One is non-GMO, the other is organic, and the final is gluten-free.
I'm always happy if people feel good about what they're eating, I suppose, but it's not necessarily doing them any good. So GMO is genetic modification, which is different than genetic engineering. Genetic modification generally means you've taken DNA from one species and transferred it to another species. Genetic engineering is simply modifying the DNA of, say, an individual plant or an animal. It's much more precise. It's much less likely to cause any sort of issue. People can advertise non-GMO, but again, it may be non-GMO, but that doesn't mean that it hasn't been crossbred to try to get the characteristics that we want. So I tend to not pay too much attention to that. Organic is an interesting category. It's generally cost more money. And the big advertisement for organic is that it's pesticide-free. Well, that's actually not accurate. 99.99% of all pesticides that you ingest are created by the plants themselves, and that's by weight. So there's always pesticides. Whether it's sprayed on or whether the plant created it itself, you are consuming pesticides. In addition, at least in the past, organic was shown to be more likely to be recalled for food poisoning. Gluten-free, if you're sensitive to gluten, that's wonderful. If you're not, I'm not sure why you'd want gluten-free.
When you did risk analysis on so many different products, explain what you were really looking to do. In other words, it might cost us a little bit more, but if you were uncertain about the safety of a food, would you err on the side of saying, look, we don't quite know, and this may cost a little bit more to the consumer, but we'd rather keep this additive out or this food coloring or whatever it may be, just in case? I mean, what was the default mechanism that you used at the FDA?
So it's still being used. The default mechanism is to err on the side of safety. And it sounds as though that should make us more safe, but it's not necessarily the case. For example, suppose you're doing a risk assessment of a new food additive, and you find some tiny risk, but yet that food additive would replace one already on the market that has a higher risk. Wouldn't you want that new one to come on if it was lower risk? Well, that's not the way that it works. They just look at how risky is it. And so just to give you an example of how this risk assessment plays out, suppose you were now to look at water and say, and use the same methodology that we use for, say, food and color additives and other compounds, say, what is water safe? If you use that methodology, it would say, if you consume more than 8 ounces of water a day, it's dangerous. Now, in reality, you need 2 to 2.5 gallons of water a day. So that kind of safety analysis is worrisome, in particular because you don't always say, okay, well, if I say that, if we then say, all right, people, you can only have one glass of water a day, what else are they going to drink, right?
Well, does that mean that when I go for a colonoscopy, I should say, I can't do it. I can't do that prep. It's too dangerous. I don't want to do it.
Hopefully not.
The dose makes the poison, in essence.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the lesson from 1600 from toxicology. And yet, I would say that's one of the hardest things to get across to the public, that dose makes the poison. How many times do you see a report comes out that says, oh my gosh, look at this produce or baby food, it's contaminated. We found traces of arsenic in it or something like that. And that sounds very scary. So again, when I talk to class about dose makes the poison, here's the example I use. Right before I go into class, I go to the water fountain in the hallway and I take a test tube and I fill it halfway up with water. And I go into the class and I say, this test tube contains water and arsenic. What I want somebody to do is drink it so we can see what happens to them. And then I walk down it and I sort of put it in front of people's faces and they recoil naturally, as anybody would. And then I drink it. And I said, the point is that most water does contain trace amounts of arsenic. That doesn't mean it's unsafe. In fact, arsenic is used to treat some kinds of cancer right now. But trace amounts don't do anything. And so that's one of the sort of big myths, and that's this dose makes the poison. It's so hard to get across to people.
When you are analyzing the foods meant for the little body, just as we've got drugs and they're being much more cautious about the vaccinations for COVID among the very young, how much sensitivity do you pay to obviously the weight of the child and such in that process? I mean, how different is the gradation of safety concern from young to old?
It's a huge difference. For children, obviously, you want to be much more careful. It's going to be a lower dose for children than it is for a full-grown adult. So, yeah, there's a lot of attention paid to that.
Let's go back to an old debate, margarine versus butter. You know, because that was such a big one for such a long period of time. I just saw a sign at a store that I was going into, something about Oleo. And I said, wow, I haven't heard the name Oleo in the longest time. I've got to ask Dr. Williams about that. But go back over that, and what can we take from that debate into the future as we look at the way the FDA works?
you know, it's a really fascinating study. Back, I guess, started in the 80s, there was a huge concern about consumption of animal fats, right? Huge deal made out of that, and we need to move to plant-based fats. And that's without knowing what we were actually moving to, again, sort of this risk-risk thing, we just moved to animal plant-based fats, and that led to trans fatty acids. Okay, so we didn't know. Everybody assumed they were safer. The activists said they were safer. Everybody was fine with that because the studies hadn't been done. We moved away from one substance and moved to another, and it turns out trans fatty acids were much, much worse for you than animal-based fats. And then, of course, as most people know, at first we had them labeled on products, and finally we banned them because they were very bad for coronary heart disease.
So are those regular and ongoing debates at the FDA? How vigorous is the dialogue and the debate about science? Because as we are finding out, even, you know, with the COVID situation, science is fluid. But science also is a participatory game, meaning there are a lot of scientists who look at each other's work. It's peer-reviewed. It's analyzed. It's got to, you know, be published in many cases so that people can poke holes at it. And I did a podcast recently where a gentleman who is a real scientist and believes in science said there's a lot that's published in Lancet or Science or Nature or any of these fine publications that really, when they go back and they look at it, it's not quite as good, the science, as we would have hoped. And then we get a revision of what that science really meant, because it is an ongoing process.
No, it's absolutely a process, and I'm always amused when people talk about settled science. This is settled. There's nothing about science. That's the sort of point of science, that it never is settled, that it's always open to challenge. And what you want is you want to have hypothesis, and you want to be able to keep rejecting alternate hypotheses, and the more you reject it, the more likely you are to believe it. But, you know, one of the problems in science today is the incentives are so bad. So, for example, if you are a scholar in a university, what you need to get funding and to get tenure is you need publications. But publications are mostly coming with positive results. That means you find, for example, a food causes an illness. That's a positive result. And the bigger the splash that you make, the better. Well, in reality, most studies ought to show either no result whatsoever or even a negative result. It's extremely hard, or at least has been up till now, to get those published. So a lot of what you see are these positive results. In some cases, the positive results are gained by taking the data and, as we say, torturing the data till it confesses. Confesses, you find a positive result by keep messing around with the data till you find what you need to get it published. And that's the same for the journals. They only want to publish positive results to keep selling journals.
Well, when we look at tobacco in the past, and we look at the fact that we were getting a lot of our research from the companies themselves, and for the longest time, we all went along with that. And we've got a lot of bigs in America, big pharma. And again, on the drug side of the FDA, where a lot of the material that they use to analyze comes from the companies, and oftentimes there's a lot of pressure because by the time there is information that gets to the regulators, it's also been out in the popular press with a headline that says, oh, this is going to be great for us. And of course, there's a perception that builds, and the company helps to build that. I'm just wondering with big food, because we don't hear a lot about big food, but I've talked a lot about big food on this podcast. They are huge. They are powerful, whether it's Archer Midland, whether it's Kellogg's, whatever it may be. I mean, what impact do they have, and what kind of resources does the FDA have to do its own work? And again, not in conflict, but just to make certain that what we're being told or what the data early on suggests will lead us to a conclusion that the public can trust.
It's a huge question. Obviously, yeah, FDA has to rely on people who have the money, basically, to do most research, but they do research themselves as well. But interestingly, a study that I saw last year, they looked at what is the probability of bias if the study is funded by, say, a private company versus if the study is funded and paid for by a government agency. And it found that probability of bias was about the same. If you're trying to get money out of government agency, say EPA, for example, you want to find something that EPA wants you to find. You want to find that something is risky that they can regulate. And it turns out the best way to avoid bias was to get something that's jointly funded by the company and the government. So I'd like to see more of those kinds of studies.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Is there anything equivalent to emergency use authorization, which is on the drug side of the FDA, in the food area? Or is it, not at all an applicable approach?
Yeah, I mean, there's no emergency food that we need. But having said that, I am worried. I do think there's a lot of new foods coming that are going to be safer and more nutritious. One of the things that I'm very excited about are the new proteins that we see on the market. And I would like to make sure that FDA and USDA, who also plays a role in this, don't unduly stop those technologies in their tracks. If they find a real problem, not a tiny, problem, that's fine. But if they find a real problem, stop it. Other than that, I think those products and similar products, such as products made by precision fermentation, are likely to be much safer, more nutritious, better for the environment. And so I think those are products that we'd like to see out. I would love to see FDA and USDA, for that matter, embrace those more and help them rather than attenuate their use.
How do they work together, the USDA and the FDA?
Not well. Just for example, one of the things that I was involved in early was we weren't not doing a lot with seafood and seafood safety. Members of Congress decided, well, since FDA isn't doing much, why don't we just transfer all seafood products over to USDA so that they would have inspectors in their plants the way they do for meat and poultry? Well, FDA, like any other regulatory agency, never wants to give up, any sort of power or oversight. So that caused us to pass an entire regulation just primarily to keep seafood at FDA. And as it turned out, the regulation didn't do hardly anything for safety and was very expensive.
When we look at sell-by dates, I mean, I'm always amazed at them. I can't quite figure out how did they come up with that, particularly on milk and other products. And then, of course, you find yourself at times taking back products because they start to smell or there's some problem with them well ahead of the sell-by date. And, of course, we all have different refrigerators and, the capacity to freeze and refrigerate things. But tell us about sell-by dates.
Sure. And there's two of them, use-by or sell-by, use-by after opening. So you have all of these things. They're basically about quality of food. And by quality, you just mentioned one, smell, for example. They're not necessarily about safety. And so they don't necessarily work for safety. In some cases, when that date is expired, it's time to toss that food out. But in some cases, the food is perfectly fine. And right now, the U.S. is one of the biggest wasters of food in the world. 40% of the food we produce just goes out into the trash, and we can do a lot better. So I mentioned earlier, what I like is the idea that you are going to have food packaging where you don't have to use by and sell by dates, but you would have something that would monitor the quality of the food, the safety of the food, and say, there are pathogens growing in this food is bad, you need to throw it out. Or some manufacturers are talking about going even further and saying they'll spray something in the food, like a tiny amount of antibiotics, to take care of it and keep the food safe for a while. So this is just new technologies, new innovations that we're seeing that will hopefully help with all of that.
Well, you're a big proponent of personalized diets. You'd like to see, new tech devices, and they are coming online clearly that are giving us a lot more information about our health. What role can they play, and is the agency embracing them?
I think the biggest role that FDA can play, and they do a lot of this now, but they can do a lot more. So in order for these new products to work, and think of like a Fitbit, but for your diet, in order for them to work, you have to know if you've just eaten something, do you get a glucose spike, for example, or what actually happens? And those are called biomarkers. And a biomarker is something like your weight or your blood pressure or something like that. But there are biomarkers that you need to monitor to find out what happens when you eat particular foods. And that's what manufacturers need that in order to make those products work. FDA can do two things in that regard. One, they can create biomarkers. These things ought to be available to everyone. But more importantly, they can validate them to make sure if a manufacturer says, I'm using a particular biomarker, FDA can say, yes, that works for what you say it does. That'd be an excellent activity for FDA to spend a lot more time on.
It's very interesting. You describe the fact that there are different kinds of people within the regulatory agency that you work in. And I just wrote a book myself, and I talked about a short stint that I had in state government. And I talked about the people who were really there because they had a lot of ambition, a lot of desire. They had a lot of capabilities, and they went on to major, activity in the political realm, the public realm, the private realm. And then, of course, there were those who were kind of there writing it out, if you will. And I'm just wondering about the collection within the FDA and the impact that those two different kinds of cultures have on the ultimate results that we get from the FDA.
I included that in my book because I wanted people to understand, sort of how decisions made in the FDA and what's it like working there. And so the very first person I encountered there was somebody I called a drone. He was absolutely in there to do as little work as possible, and he did. At one point, I remember that he went and spent all day at the junkyard looking for parts for his car, and then he came back in an hour after he was supposed to, which meant he got a so-called credit hour, meaning he could take another hour off. And he actually, when he was challenged by that, he just said, well, it's the principle. That's when I clocked out, so I should get the credit hour. So we have, there were a lot of drones. There were a lot of people, as you suggest, that were, I call power files. They were in it to get more power. They loved the power, actually for themselves and for the agency. The ones that I felt sort of sorry for almost was just people I generally termed as scientists. They came in, they wanted to do good science, and they were astounded when they finally got to attend a decision meeting and found out that all decisions are made politically, because FDA, like other executive branch agency, is a political agency, and politics is what drives the decisions. Now, that can be great, but it can also be a problem.
And what kind of politics gets in the way of the safety and maybe the nutritious value of food? In other words, who's trying to influence a congressman or a senator who's then trying to put some pressure on the FDA?
Well, just for example, food companies, particularly large food companies, can be very powerful, and they're constantly lobbying Congress and the FDA. And one of the things that results from that is FDA will create a rule where the requirements are much harder on small businesses than they are on large businesses. Large businesses can either do them more cheaply, say, per product, or they've already done them. There are two laws that are in place, the 1980 Regulatory Flexibility Act, for example, that says that FDA and other agencies have to look at the disparate impact between small and large businesses. And they have to give small businesses some kind of a break if it's not going to be make their products look safe. That particular law and the one that actually strengthened it in 1986 are still not strong enough. So a lot of small businesses which don't have the resources to lobby and are also afraid to lobby, get caught in the middle there.
How well does the FDA communicate what its requirements do put upon a small manufacturer of food versus a large? How well do they communicate what the expectations are and the reasons for them?
Toward the end of my career, I did a survey of food companies, and it wasn't, it was for a specific reason, but it was all food companies, so we sampled them. And about 30% of the small businesses that we sampled came back with the survey that were actually governed by FDA said, we don't think we're governed by FDA. So they didn't even know because FDA hadn't gotten around to inspecting. They didn't even know they were governed by FDA. And so what happens is when FDA puts out a regulation in the Federal Register, most small businesses don't have the time, they don't have the legal staff to read it and to know, is this something that applies to me? So they don't comment on it. Then it goes into final rule and ends up in the Code of Federal Regulations, and they don't read that either. So the first time they'll find out about this is when an inspector does show up and say, hey, you're not doing X. So it's a real problem.
Yeah, but that's like 6 years down the road.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, in closing, if there was something that we should be looking for in the future, you talked about the personalized diets and the hope that the FDA will help to make certain that the instrumentation used in that process is effective and true. If we look at other food safety issues, I mean, what do you think needs the most reckoning and the most attention, you know, as we go forward?
I would like to see more people reading about genetically engineered foods so that they're not necessarily afraid of just the idea of genetic engineering, but read about how safe they are, read about what they actually do, and look for those because they're going to be safer and more nutritious foods. Also, another new technology that's coming along that I think is fascinating are 3D food printers. So this is where you put in your fats, your proteins, and your carbohydrates and perhaps flavors, and you can print out all kinds of different foods. Sort of the nice thing about that is if it's if you have different members of the family, you can print out a different food for different members of the family based on their nutritional needs, as well as you can print out just as much that they need to eat so you're not throwing a lot of foods out. So those are fascinating. They're just really, I think, at their inception, but another interesting thing I think for people to look at.
In closing, the issue of food insecurity, I mean, you talk about all the waste in America, and I'm just wondering how the FDA looks at that or has any interest in what they see going on as it relates to food insecurity, food deserts in America. Any of that cross the board at the FDA?
Well, food insecurity is not a huge issue with FDA, and it's really, in fact, food insecurity is more an issue for the world. As you know, we have a huge growing population. We're going to have to increase food production by about half by 2050. So a lot of these new things, like, for example, the new proteins and all foods that are made by precision fermentation and labs, those are going to be absolutely necessary to feed a growing world population. This is not something that typically FDA worries about. This is more, I think, a USDA issue. But there's a lot we can do, and I'd like people to be aware of that.
Well, I've got to thank you. There was so much that we covered today. Richard Williams, a PhD, an economist, somebody who worked at the FDA for many years. What was it, 27 years?
27 years, yes.
All right. Fixing Food, an FDA insider, unravels the myths and the solutions. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you for having me, and please go to my website, richardawilliams.com.
Okay, terrific. Thanks again, Richard.
Okay, thank you.